Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 27, 2020, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the development of the 5G network. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel of the Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers on today's call. We're very pleased to welcome three guests to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them in turn of about 5 to 10 minutes or so on the topic, and then we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. We're going to hear first from John Neuer. He's president and founder of JKC Consulting, former Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Communications and Information, principal advisor to the President of the United States on telecommunications policy, and the administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. Second in our lineup will be Patricia Paoletta, partner at Harris, Wilcher & Grannis, where she specializes in telecommunications trade and technology policy. And then we'll finish up with opening remarks with Lawrence Spiwak, president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies, which is a nonprofit 501c3 organization that studies broad public policy issues related to governance, social and economic conditions, with a particular emphasis on the law and economics of the digital age. With that, John Neuer, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, very much. And thanks, everyone, my fellow panelists, for joining and for those of you dialing in. I thought I'd open the discussion on 5G with a somewhat backward-looking view at the traditional telecommunications policy, legal, and regulatory framework. And the reason I wanted to talk about that is because the challenge with 5G, or how 5G has evolved as a policy discussion in the United States and I think internationally, is that it's a telecommunications subject, but it is now perceived as so cross-cutting in terms of its macroeconomic impact, its trade impact, its security impact, that voices not typically involved in the telecommunications legal and policy debate are increasingly becoming heavily involved. Historically, and you know, when I was in government and as a legal practitioner around the telecommunications regulatory space, there were very traditional sources of authority and of policymaking influence. Inside the Congress, the focus was in the Commerce Committees in the House and the Senate, with a secondary or a companion role by the Judiciary Committees to the extent that antitrust issues around former monopolies and the merging of companies were involved. Within the executive branch, there is the agency inside the Commerce Department that I had the privilege of leading during the second Bush administration, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which has a dual policy function, dual responsibilities as the manager of all the federal government radio spectrum, and then also as the principal advisor to the president on economic policy issues that pertain to telecommunications in the economy. And then, of course, there's the Federal Communications Commission, independent agency, as the primary regulator, again, with a companion role by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, on some competition issues. And typically, industry and government equities around telecommunications issues knew where to plug in to each of these components. So if Congress was taking up a piece of reform, a pro-competition statute, the place you go to talk is to the Commerce Committees, who have jurisdiction over oversight jurisdiction over both NTIA and the administration and the FCC. They've got the institutional knowledge and the subject matter expertise. If that legislation were going to impact federal equities in some way, very often in the relocation of spectrum, been a long history of Congress passing legislation directing the administration to identify spectrum to be repurposed for commercial use. NTIA and the administration would have views on that. NTIA, while housed inside the Commerce Department, is actually tasked with being the representative of all of the federal government equities that have an interest in a spectrum issue or a telecommunications policy issue. And then obviously, of course, and most directly is the Federal Communications Commission as the primary regulator of the telecommunications industry. So that legal structure, that legal regulatory policy structure, which has been applied to every telecommunications issue, whether it has been spectrum issues, it is network security issues, broadcast issues, whatever it may be, that has been the well-understood legal policy and regulatory framework. I think the interesting thing and the challenging thing with regards to 5G is that it has taken on this life of its own where it is viewed by stakeholders across the government and across the economy as something much more important and bigger than pure telecommunications policy. So there are clear national security issues around the manufacture of these networks and the control of the supply chain. There are broad macroeconomic issues that are being managed and, you know, voiced in the White House through the National Economic Council, because this is viewed as a transformative comparative advantage that the United States could gain or lose in our international trading relationships. There are public safety and other issues. And so as each of those equities are identified, new regulatory and legal paths open up to influence 5G policy and 5G outcome. So I'm going to turn it over to Tricia to talk a little bit about that dynamic and about how the growth of 5G is sort of a pan-economic, if that is even a word or a concept. Larry will correct me later, but something that is so all-encompassing to our economy that it's broken out of the telecom legal regulatory space. And what does that mean? Is that accurate? If it is accurate, what does that mean for law and policy on something as important and that cuts across as much of the economy as this?
Thank you, guys. As John noted, right, it is pan-economic. I like that term, but until Larry says we can't use it. But and the reason that is, I'm just going to back up a little bit and try to explain what 5G might be, because obviously it is a term used by anybody who wants anything in Washington these days. But the mobile operators and their vendors would define 5G as that which comes out of their standards body, which is 3GPP, and that's an amalgam of different regional, you know, global regional standards bodies. And as they've defined it, or, you know, and as they've defined their standards, which they then take to the United Nations International Telecom Union, you know, there's three major types of applications for 5G. You have what most listeners might think of as just, you know, your faster smartphone, enhanced mobile broadband, or, you know, it might also go into other applications like the virtual reality glasses that gamers might use or whatever. But enhanced mobile broadband, largely for the consumer or the enterprise, because we all know digital communications has gotten so widespread in our economy. Everybody, almost every service sector is out there with their iPads and their, you know, sensors and what have you. But so enhanced mobile broadband, and then critical communications is another kind of suite of 5G applications, and that would be ultra-reliable, low-latency communications, things where you just cannot have any latency, such as in, you know, connected cars. So that's another promise of 5G, is that, you know, much wider broadband channels, but also very low latency. So, you know, connected cars, like I said, telemedicine, one day, maybe even remote surgeries, earthquake sensing, anywhere where you absolutely have to have no latency, or, you know, very complex industrial applications. But then you have, you know, another range of applications, Internet of Things, and that can be slower communications. It might be sensor data from millions of different devices spread out across some kind of broad network, like, you know, environmental sensing, or again, earthquake sensing. But there, the 5G standards, again through 3GPP, have been developed to have massive connectivity. And that's the game changer from 4G as well. I mean, 4G, fast smartphones, 5G will be faster smartphones. But with 5G, you have much, much denser connected IoT networks. And I think that, in addition to the other applications, but primarily the Internet of Things application, I think is where some of the security concerns from our, you know, national security agencies and our Defense Department and from, you know, commerce and from a range of agencies get more interested, because with each new connected link, right, that's another threat vector, right, another surface where information could be attacked and targeted. And of course, in the early days of Internet of Things, because that's been out, for a long time at this point through earlier technology, you didn't have as many things connected, so you did have as many, threat surfaces. So I think it's that which has gotten people nervous. And of course, in some of the other applications, right, with critical communications or enhanced mobile broadband, you have the ability through, a range of these 5G applications to enhance machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I think, that is where we've gotten 20 minutes into this. We haven't even said, win the race to 5G. But, that is why the U.S. agencies have been so focused on winning the race to 5G, as has the industry. And some of that's been hyped to get more spectrum. We can talk about that later. But it is because the widespread deployment of 5G will better position the U.S. to have the infrastructure in place to do more enhancement and development of artificial intelligence, machine learning. And I think those are the critically advantageous technologies of the future that position the U.S. to be on the leading and the innovation curve, right? So that is why you get all these agencies very excited about it. Now, and again, what is 5G? 5G is, like I said, used by the mobile operators and the vendors as what they've defined in what they call release standard of coming out of 3GPP, release 15 and 16 and 17 they're working on. So it's release 15 and above. But 5G, it's not a term that they only claim to. So you also have the Wi-Fi crowd, the 802.11 crowd saying, Wi-Fi 6, what we're developing is critical to the 5G ecosystem because, as we've seen, every new generation of cellular, particularly since 3G and 4G, has relied also on Wi-Fi offload. 5G is not just one standard, it's a whole ecosystem, which, we also didn't say until, 20 minutes into this. But anyway, I think because of what these technologies can do in terms of the broader innovative competitiveness of the U.S., in a global market, that is why, and of course the security threats, as I mentioned, that's why you have these agencies so focused on it. But, and Larry can talk on a little bit more about what it is, what it isn't, how it's driving policy. But, because this is a legal call, right, I thought I'd spend a moment on what has been happening in this space. And obviously was it 2017? It was pretty early days, 2018, when there was a memo that was snuck out of the White House that proposed to nationalize 5G. Obviously, that got battened down, but it does reflect how intense are the feelings of the Defense Department and others in terms of the need to make sure it's a secure network and the U.S. is harnessing this new technology to position itself for these technologies of the future. But more recently, of course, all this has been also wrapped up in concerns about, Chinese vendors, right? Huawei and ZTE, to give a name to it. So I think you had this coalescence of realizing the importance of 5G in terms of economic innovation and also realizing, okay, we've been turning a blind eye to surveillance and intellectual property theft from China for too long. And given their more aggressive stance over the last decade in terms of a range of activities, building islands off in the China Sea and what have you, with their Made in China 2025 strategy, I think a lot of these concerns about the U.S.'s competitiveness in 5G has aligned with a more clear-eyed view of what China had been doing to put itself in a leading position in telecommunications policy, particularly 5G. And, of course, the Made in 2025 strategy by the Chinese certainly includes the telecom space. And so, that has aligned. So that this administration, and I'll wrap up quickly, Larry, but this administration, had a national cyber strategy that was put out early in the administration talking about the need to secure 5G networks and be a leader on it. So both, the security side as well as the technological leadership side. In May of 2019, the president put out an executive memo on securing the supply chain of information communications technology supply. That's being worked on. And of course, just yesterday, right, they put out their national strategy on securing 5G. They had been working on that, but that was also in reaction or will fulfill the very recently passed and signed bill called Secure 5G and Beyond. So there's, you know, a lot of activity that has really coalesced just in the last month or so on making sure that 5G is secure and that, again, the U.S. continues to be very innovative in this space because, you know, just China with the sheer numbers, right? They're a much bigger country and they've had basically an industrial policy where the Chinese government mandates that the three mobile operators in their country, which are all Chinese owned, you know, all government owned, have to buy Huawei and ZTE at above global market rates. So they get subsidizations with their own country by mandating the purchase of Huawei and ZTE equipment. So then Huawei and ZTE and others can go around the world selling it at rock bottom prices and beat out any Western supplier. So this has been kind of a crystallization of both the importance of 5G in terms of economic innovation across the board, but also, you know, realization that China has been doing policies that are contrary to, you know, how the U.S. has structured its market and our Western allies. So I've veered off into a lot of subjects. I'm going to stop here and turn it to Larry.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate to be on the call with everybody today. So as Dean said at the beginning, I work at a think tank, so we don't lobby, we don't write pleadings. And that distance allows you sometimes to get sort of a healthy skepticism of what's going on. We focus on the law and economics of the problem, but it allows us to sort of sit back and watch the political passion play come out. So, you know, you hear a lot about the phrase 5G. We've talked about that. So I guess to start my presentation, it's like, what exactly does the race to 5G mean? And we've all been doing this business a long time. And what I have learned is that to get things done in Washington, you need a slogan. We've always had a good slogan. We've had the digital divide. We got the homework gap. We had the exaflood, broadband for everybody. Now we've got winning the race to 5G. And I think it's great because, you know, we finally get some motivation. I mean, my regret is after being involved sort of watching since the wireless industry sort of exploded, I wish we would put this much effort in the first generation, second generation, third generation, fourth generation. But we're doing it now. That's really good to know. But the flip side of that is the slogans do not provide answers to, as John said, sort of the complex legal and economic questions that you're always having to deal with in terms of spectrum policy. But we do have a slogan. The slogan gets you perhaps a political cover to move forward where we've had difficulties in the past. So let me give three examples where I think the administration, and I use that phrase very broadly in terms of all of, in fact, all of Washington, has been able to use this concept of the race to 5G to do some good. I think the first and foremost is that it has now created the impetus and a good story to really focus on a longstanding problem in telecom, which is removing local government barriers to entry. This has been a problem that has plagued the industry for years, tower siting in particular, and now the FCC, to its credit, is really stepping up and trying to do what it can to remove those barriers. That case is now pending, I think, in front of the Ninth Circuit. But they deserve a lot of credit for pushing the edge of that envelope. That's always a very delicate thing when you start telling states and localities what they can do. But that's been, I think, a real plus out of using the mantra of winning the race to 5G. And the second thing is spectrum repurposing. I don't think we're quite there yet, but at least we're talking about it. There's a lot of problems with as former NTIA Dave Reddell said a while back, the era of easy spectrum decisions are over. So we can talk about, you know, various spectrum repurposings, which is sort of a subsidiary of this, but at least we're having that conversation. And I think probably the most important of this, and we've talked about this on the call so far, is that the federal government is finally really aggressively taking steps to protect the nation's critical infrastructure. This has been a longstanding problem. And now we're seeing very concrete action to a very, very real problem. So I think the administration deserves a lot of kudos for that. As I think John mentioned, you know, they just released, I guess last week, the National Strategy to Secure 5G plan, the administration did. We have our positives, but let's also be honest. As politicians are not telecom lawyers or economists, slogans can be used, and I think that has increasingly led to cutting a lot of legal corners. And that is what's very troubling to me. You know, the hype coming out of some circles has been really amazing. Although I disagree with Senator Kennedy on his approach to C-band, if you caught his speech on the Senate floor, he was lamenting on how badly the hype is about 5G, and he actually said, and I'm repeating this because these are Senator Kennedy's words, not mine, 5G is so wonderful, it can cure erectile dysfunction. And I wanted to say that on a FedSoc call, but again, his words. Now I've seen everything. If the senator can say that on the floor, that's where we are in the U.S. telecom debate. You know, but I think he has a point about the overhype. And you're starting to see, again, a lot of corners being cut or things that might have been subject to stricter scrutiny but for telling the story of the magic of 5G. And let me give three examples in my mind. One is the Sprint T-Mobile merger. I don't have a dog in the fight. You know, should the equilibrium be 3? Should the equilibrium be 4? Maybe it's 3. You know, we've gone through this whole zeitgeist of, you know, we'll let, you know, Sprint T-Mobile merge, and then Dish will come in, and they're going to build a fourth. I mean, putting all that aside, what I find interesting, and I use that word with a bit of sarcasm, is that this whole deal was justified, and you see a lot of conservatives making this argument, that it's okay because of the imposition of totally uneconomic, voluntary build-out requirements. Now, if this would have been the prior administration and former FCC Tom Wheeler would have done this and the Obama administration, people would have been up in arms. This is horrible. This is horrible. But now we see, oh, but it's great. It's 5G on economic build-out requirements. We need to sort of, you know, highlight that. Second example I think you see, and this has been a huge fight here in Washington, is a company called Legato Networks. Legato Networks was a company approved on delegated authority under the Obama administration, thinking that they can have yet another facilities-based network. It wasn't even approved by the commission, and they were going to use this L-band spectrum. And it turns out after they approved it, because they promised, and we've heard this before, a new nationwide network, turns out that there was massive interference. And the FCC, after they granted it, the FAA came in and NTIA came in and said, you have a real interference problem here. Fix it. So for the last 10 years, Legato has been trying to fix that. And they've made some issues, but the FCC's rules are very clear. The burden is on that company to show that they have satisfied all interference concerns. Right? They can do it. Fantastic. But NTIA, working with a bunch of executive branch agencies, has said, look, we have interference concerns. But yet now you're having all these other agencies jump in. Bill Barr has jumped in. He said, oh, you know, you should grant it. I'm not sure what the Department of Justice's broadband portfolio is, but now you have all these different agencies because they're selling it as, well, this is great. We need the mid-band spectrum. Well, I'm sure we'd all like to have extra mid-band spectrum, but that's not the issue. The legal issue is, have you satisfied the FCC's rules or not? And you see that a lot going around. People are forgetting that there are rules. So either we have rules at the commission that are enforceable or they're not. And that's an example. And then I think the third example you're starting to see is this company called Rivada Network, which is Newt Gingrich, has been very critical, where they basically want to get access to government-owned spectrum held by the DOD. And this was floated, I guess, about a year and a half ago, that the government should own a government-owned network, or at least a private partner network. And that will provide 5G. And I remember I was driving downtown somewhere, and Newt Gingrich goes, because this will totally change the economics with 5G, and it'll drive the Chinese out. The only thing, I've been doing this business a long time, and I work with some of the best economists in this business, and the only thing that that kind of is going to do, having government network, is drive out the private sector, because if the equilibrium can only sustain one firm, having somebody come and have predatory entry by the government's not going to do it. You know, you're starting to see this race to 5G stuff really just get out of control, in my mind, just in terms of the discussion, because I think for those of us, certainly the three of us who are on this call who have been doing this a long time, telecom is a hard business. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's going on of how do you repurpose spectrum from low to high value uses? How do you deal with interference externalities? How do you deal with, if you're trying to do a market-based solution, so to speak, how do you then deal with holdouts where the last person says, no, I don't want to do that? Do you have a transaction window? These are the issues that I think that we need to be focusing on. But yet when people start throwing around this phrase 5G, that's not an excuse to cut corners. So with that, that's sort of my take on that.
Well, thank you all. I want to give John and Trish a chance to expand their thoughts.
Yeah, part of the theme is people not staying in their lane. I'll jump mine and pretend to be a moderator here for a moment. But it's interesting to me because part of our underlying question we're supposed to answer, right? Has spectrum policy become too diffuse in this era of 5G? And both John and Larry's remarks made me think of, you know, other criticism I've seen of some of the other agencies where they've, you know, not played ball with the FCC or with NTIA and kind of gotten out there in front and kind of on their own letterhead sent letters off to the FCC. And I'm thinking of like Department of Energy with respect to the FCC's proposal with the 6 gigahertz band for next generation Wi-Fi and other unlicensed technologies, or Department of Transportation, you know, sending off messages and, you know, what have you, with in the 5.9 gigahertz spectrum for connected car technology, you know, sending that off to the FCC and not going through the, you know, the proper channel of NTIA, which is supposed to manage federal spectrum. So question to John is this really unprecedented? Did you see when you were running NTIA, didn't you see some agencies kind of getting over their skis and trying to go around behind NTIA's back and deal directly with the FCC? Or is something about 5G really made everybody's heads explode and, you know, jump in their lanes?
That's interesting, Tricia, because I was going to circle back to that exact point. Larry, you quoted one of my successors, David Reddle, saying that the days of easy spectrum decisions were over. They weren't easy before, right? I'll have to give David a call about that for precisely the reasons you're talking about, Tricia, that going back to 1G, well, certainly, you know, 2G, the second G, the first digital spectrum allocations and the first spectrum that was auctioned off, those were the first bands of spectrum that required the federal government to clear out of the space that they were occupying. As a consequence, every spectrum decision going back to the mid-90s has impacted significant federal government equities. And the challenge has always been to resolve those equities within the executive branch and then speak with a single voice. The guidance that we got when I was in government was when we've got a choice between preserving our national security or our economic security, we do both. And if there are hard operational challenges, we wrestle those hard operational challenges to the ground under the guidance of the final authority in the executive branch, which is the president. And that would be done through coordination of the National Economic Council. So the policy coordination process in any administration requires diverse equities inside the government to be corralled and managed through the White House process. So while there may be issues at the Defense Department that trigger national security issues, there may be issues in the Transportation Department that trigger economic security issues or just broader economic issues. And to the extent that at the staff level, the sub-cabinet level, those are not being coordinated and resolved through NTIA, then those things get elevated into the White House, and the White House convenes a policy coordination process with the specific White House equities, with the National Security Council, National Economic Council, the Office of Management and Budget, policy apparatus, and you bring that interagency negotiation into the White House, and compromises are struck on these issues. And ultimately, they can start at an assistant secretary level, they can start at a deputy's level, move to what they call a principal's level. And ultimately, the ultimate policy coordination process in any administration is time in the Oval Office with the president making a decision on what the go-forward strategy of his administration is going to be. In my experience, having telecom policy issues go all the way through to the Oval means that the people below did not do their jobs very well. There always has to be a way to resolve these things. I would quibble a little bit with you, Larry, on your articulation that the standard for incumbents or proponents of a use of spectrum is that they must resolve, quote unquote, all complaints. A complaint isn't enough, but I think you make a very good point that people are using 5G as a thumb on the scale to give their particular complaints greater value or greater weight in this messy coordination process. I think that's what 5G is putting pressure on the system, that different equities in the government say, I'm not going to engage in a telecom policy process. I'm the Defense Department. I'm going to say what I want to say, and I'm going to say it directly. And you understand where that sort of impetus comes from. The challenge is having the White House managing a process to say, guys, I get it. You're important. But this is a whole of government issue. And how do we corral that together?
What does this all mean? Coordinating policy is one thing, but when agencies are influencing, if not setting policy through enforcement actions, what's the mechanism for a unified or unitary executive? And here I'm thinking in particular of the FTC Qualcomm case, where what I'm hearing from people, and I'm no expert, but I'm hearing this has national security implications. FTC's started an enforcement action over the objection of one of its own commissioners, and it's persisted. It seems to be beyond the control of the White House, and yet I'm being told it has national security implications. So I'm curious as to how you end up with a unitary executive when you have independent agencies not just setting policy through formal processes but through enforcement actions. But I'll set that aside for now, but let's turn now to our first caller.
First, let me warn you, you're talking to a man who still uses a flip phone, so I'm a bit out of my depth, but I'm interested in the policy. And the last two comments have touched on the thing that interests me the most. It seems that the perspective of national security is the principal one, because if the Red Chinese win this thing, then the value of 5G to the American industry is going to be largely that, how much they can export it. But the unitary executive is the issue. Is there a value or a necessity or even a danger of a drug czar, I hate to use that phrase, but one office, one cabinet, one person inside or outside the White House who's got the ultimate authority to look at the matter from the perspective of national security and economic interest? Is that possible or even feasible or desirable given the disaster that turned out with Homeland Security, where they tried to coordinate intelligence gathering and putting it under one agency, which turned out to be, I think, a failure looking back on it historically? So that's my question.
I'll go first. That one executive is the chief executive, right? It's the president because, as John kind of mentioned, you have NEC, the National Economic Council, led by Larry Kudlow, who's giving his economic perspectives on 5G policy. But you also have the National Security Advisor weighing in on some of the security issues. And they do often, as we know, have different takes on this, on a range of issues, including on spectrum repurposing and how much the government might lead on the R&D and how much we let the private sector do that. Obviously, Larry Kudlow has been a big champion of letting the markets work and the private sector work to the extent possible. So those two advisors to the president duke it out, and it's the president who ultimately makes the decision. But on the unitary executive, on the FCC front, yeah, obviously there's a longstanding debate in legal circles, including in the Federal Society and some of the members, on whether FTC, FCC, whether these independent agencies are even legal, right, or lawful, constitutional under our structure, since, if they're executing policy, aren't they supposed to be in the executive branch? But, of course, Congress, who created these agencies, consider them to be operating under their delegated interstate commerce authority. So, nobody's going to solve that in the near term, right? There might be some lawsuits that try to tee those issues up. But at least with respect to the FCC, this chairman has been no blushing violet, naysayer on security policy. I mean, he has been fairly aggressive in terms of going along with trying to get Huawei equipment out of the network. He's already moved in his decision in late fall, in November, to rule that universal service contributions that come in from licensed operators in the U.S. that go to support more economically challenged areas, the carriers in those rural areas or low-income areas cannot use those subsidies to buy Chinese equipment. So he's already moved on that. And in that order where he made that decision, he referenced the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, 2019, which came out of course, the Senate and House Armed Services Committees, where they said, basically, we don't want any Huawei equipment in there. Everybody has to do what they can to, cross the board and all the agencies to make sure we get Chinese equipment out of the network. So he's implemented already a decision on that, looking at that. So the lawfulness of an independent agency like an FTC or FCC will remain, I think, an issue in legal circles for, the foreseeable future. But at least the chairman on the FCC side has been doing his part in terms of trying to go along with the administration policy on trying to minimize Chinese influence, and including on denying China Mobile's application and, you know, a bunch of other issues that he's done. On FTC, I'm going to have to defer to some of my colleagues on the call, but I suspect that this president would not be shy if the ultimate ruling was something that he viewed threatened the security of the United States. I obviously have no insight on that, but he's certainly weighed in on and done, you know, executive orders reversing some of the agency decisions when he felt it was in the security interest of the U.S. to do so.
Well, just to sort of just jump in, and John probably can do this. I mean, when we talk about these other federal agencies, understand that NTIA is designed to handle basically the executive branch agencies to coordinate federal government spectrum use. It's only the, if we're getting into the unitary executive issue. I mean, the FCC handles, is designed to handle commercial spectrum. But the big issue is that there's a lot of federal spectrum users out there, ranging DOD being the largest one. But the DOT is a huge user of spectrum. NOAA is another really big one. Weather Service, that sort of thing. So having that all sort of within, having all federal spectrum use administered by the executive branch is not, in my mind, a major constitutional problem here.
We do have another question from our audience. Let's check in with our next caller.
I think you answered it about the Huawei concerns, but if anybody else wanted to comment.
Anyone want to weigh in further on Huawei versus the U.S.?
I think what is happening is a potential shift in policy thinking about how to deal with Huawei. There is a widely shared perception that Huawei as a company's relationship with the Chinese government presents a significant security concern. And the security concern is two leveled. The most direct level is that they would have to be responsive to Chinese government requests to infiltrate the network. And, you know, can we have confidence that the equipment is not compromised? So that's the one sort of basic level of just the, because of the structure of and the relationship of Chinese industry with the Chinese government, that that represents a threat. The second threat comes from what Tricia was talking about in terms of the economic benefits they get, both in terms of indirect subsidies and direct subsidies and low-cost loans, such that all profit-making ability is squeezed out of the telecommunications infrastructure space, and that there's no room in the marketplace for non-Chinese manufacturers. Those Western companies' firms fail, and critical telecommunications infrastructure is sole-sourced in China or Asia at the very least. So those are the issues that the government has been trying to deal with, and there has been a direct approach where the security agencies in the U.S. government simply tell U.S. companies, you can't put Huawei equipment into your core network, and then put pressure on our allied trading partners to say, if you want to have a shared intelligence relationship with the United States government, you too cannot put Huawei into your network. And that was sort of a blunt force tool to solve both of those problems. It's becoming untenable, in particular with regards to our trading partners, where our trading partners are saying, we can't just keep Huawei out of the network. The cost advantages are too great. We can't ask our carriers to pay more and pass things on. So what we'll do, what the UK did is they said, we will allow no more than 30% of any network to be comprised of Huawei equipment. That creates a market space for Western firms to enter into. I think there's a sense that that too is unlikely to be sustainable in the long term. So where the move is going is promoting what they call virtual networks or open networks, where all of the intelligence of the network moves into the software layer. And the hardware, the equipment, that can become a cheap commodity and nobody cares from a security standpoint. And also, Western firms are much more diverse and present much more competition in the software space. So that is introducing entirely new legal and regulatory regimes into this space. And it also introduces challenges. There is great concern amongst many in the industry that ORAN, Open Radio Access Networks. They could introduce their own security challenges. They may not be ready for network-wide deployment. And if the government is going to step in and start making network decisions, it's going to do it badly. There are the flip sides of that that say it's the only path that we have. And I know Tricia has thought a lot about this, and Larry may have thoughts as well. That's a new intersection of the national security apparatus with the regulatory framework.
You've quite identified one of the leading issues where this is all coming to a head. Or, you know, if we do open networks, can we thereby help U.S. carriers and our allies, you know, allies around the world, from becoming less reliant on Huawei? Because part of the issue, too, is when Huawei would sell a system, you to evolve and buy newer equipment that's going to help you upgrade to, you know, from 3G to 4G, 4G to 5G, you are stuck in that ecosystem. You were stuck with having to work with Huawei because of how it was all integrated into the hardware. But as John said, you know, part of the open radio access network movement is to, right, if you virtualize some of those functions in the network and you're not just relying on the metal boxes, but a lot of the functionality will be done through software, you're freeing the operators, you know, for the next generation or for, you know, building in or adding new features to their services. They can actually go with a different firm's software and, you know, get the same functionality, but not relying on Huawei, including, you know, more secure features too. So that is, there's a lot of emphasis right now in the Trump administration, and, you know, and certainly at the FCC. Yesterday they were going to have a virtualized radio access network workshop, but because of COVID, that was scuttled for the time being. But, you know, so there is a focus on that to help, you know, on two fronts, free the operators from reliance on Huawei, which has been subsidized to the point where, right, the competitive Western vendors like Nokia or Samsung or Ericsson or others were just too expensive. But one point I do want to raise, and now we're really tangential, but there has been a narrative, particularly in Europe, where they've said, well, gosh, you know, there were no other choices. We only had, you know, the cheap subsidized Huawei or, you know, the other Western vendors I just mentioned, they're too expensive. But there is a range of U.S. entities, Cisco, Mavenir, you know, a lot of software guys who are part of that broader ecosystem. So I guess part of my message is it's not so dire that we don't just have, you know, a handful of operators in the space. But because of that focus on open RAN, right? The hope is that, yeah, more and more U.S. competitive entities can get involved in that space and kind of free the operators from the clutches of Huawei or ZTE.
Larry, any comment on this?
I think they both hit it. I mean, I don't think people sort of realize that when you build a network, and this is the problem that we're talking about, is that it's just not the network, but it's all the back office and support system. And years ago, I was doing some work in Brazil of all places, and we were saying, well, why doesn't so-and-so buy that network or that? Because, well, that's a Nortel network and that's a Lucent network, and the two don't talk to each other. And so is the Chinese. I mean, what they're doing right now is, you know, going around, particularly the developed worlds, going, hey, you want a network? We'll be glad to come in and bring you one. By the way, sign right here. But they're not hiring the locals. They're just sending over tons of Chinese nationals to build the network in, you know, Nigeria or something like that. So the locals are very upset about that. That's yet another reason why we have the coronavirus. This is a real problem, and I've got friends of mine in the administration, and they're really waking up to this. They're realizing, going, you know, we can't have, you know, the Chinese go in. It's kind of on a way almost like a CLEC bubble from years ago, but except for it's backed by the full faith and credit by the Chinese government, where, you know, the Chinese government is willing to give these very, very poor developing countries loans to go buy this stuff. So, oh, sure, why not? And then if they default, then the Chinese government just essentially takes over the network. But they're also doing it, you know, for other critical infrastructure. This is a real problem. This is not a new issue dealing with backdoors at Huawei. And I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago, one committee in the House came up and flagged this for the first time. And I remember being asked to do Chinese television, and I was sort of nervous, like, you know, what do I do about this? U.S. carriers, particularly, you know, the large ones who have large government contracts, understand the duty to care that, you know, the last thing they want to do is put it in the back door. And some of our carriers have been pretty good about this. But, you know, we are just one segment of the global internet, and the stuff that everybody's talking about here today, this is a real fundamental problem. So as we can move into that and break that logger jam, is a good thing.
And one other little point, not only does Huawei, you know, have the Chinese bank subsidizing its deployments overseas, they're not quite as constrained by anti-corruption laws as some of the Western vendors or and the U.S. vendors, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Obviously, our vendors operate under that. I attended the World Radio Conference late last year, and we were trying to convince some of the African countries to go our way, the U.S. position on a particular spectrum band, and arguing that this was really better for them, and, you know, don't go with this Chinese argument, and, you know, why are you so reliant on them anyway? And this particular African delegate said, well, you don't build churches for us. So it's not just that they're giving away cheap gear. They're doing a lot of additional, you know, sweeteners to their offers. So, it's a very pernicious and widespread problem. But, yeah, this administration certainly is focused on trying to do what they can to turn that ship around.
By the way, one quick thing I forgot to mention, and you really don't have to give Ajit Pai credit where credit is due. I guess it was a couple months ago, I don't have the exact time, but China Telecom, in order to provide service in the United States, you have to get what's called a 214 certificate, which is basically an old common vestige of the 34 Communications Act, but basically gives you the authority to provide service in the United States. And by a 5-0 vote, that means the three Republicans and the two Democrats, and there's a lot of fighting over the commission, but it was a unanimous vote. They voted to revoke China Telecom's permission to provide service here. You know, a reporter called me up and asked me about this. Look, I don't know what information they saw, but the fact that in these political times that you got a 5-0 vote, that was a very serious thing that they had to do, particularly with the the geopolitical implications of having a small agency saying, no, China, you can't provide, China Telecom, you can't provide service. So, again, Ajit should get tremendous credit for stepping up to the plate on this.
Well, it looks like we're out of audience questions, but we're just about out of time as well. So let me give each of you a chance to express a final thought, maybe 30 seconds or so, in the order we had our opening remarks. John Neuer, final thought?
You know, put all of this in context of where we are as a nation and what we're experiencing right now, I think it's just, you know, it's also important to note that while 5G may be waved around as sort of the magic answer to all things, the policies that have led to the robust investment in these networks for more or less varying degrees bipartisan basis, we have had a pro-competition, pro-investment policy in this country. Led us through 1G, 2G, 3G, 4G. It's a factor in the deployment of fiber and coaxial cables around the country, innovations in Wi-Fi and unlicensed and licensed spectrum. And we as a nation are reaping the benefits of those policy decisions right now. Our economy has shifted almost entirely onto these networks, networks that are designed for varying amounts of throughput. So you don't expect that every school child is not in school, instead at home trying to video conference all at the same time, while all of us are out of our offices and in our homes on telenetworking. And the networks are standing up to the challenge, and we ought to take a moment to acknowledge that success and think about the policies that brought us there.
Well said, John. Well, we only have a minute left, so I'll be even perhaps more brief. While I certainly acknowledge that the race to 5G as a slogan has been overused and overhyped in the U.S. to push a particular proponent's policy goals, I mean, that certainly has been done, or to, you know, perhaps right, cut some corners, as Larry noted. The U.S. is not alone in this focus on it because, I mean, 5G has already, since it's been begun to be deployed last year globally, or, you know, certainly in some leading countries like South Korea, certainly China and the U.S., to date, it has been the fastest taken up technology out there, the fastest G ever. I mean, we already have about 17 million subscriptions globally. And again, the United Nations, the International Telecommunications Union, called this technology International Mobile Telecom 2020. The goal originally when this was first thought about was to get this deployed in 2020. But it, you know, already, because of its importance to countries around the world, it's already been deployed by a number of countries, you know, well in advance of the original goal. So it's not just the U.S. and some, you know, good lobbyists who have leveraged you know, the President Trump's interest in being first in everything, right? This is a globally recognized technology that can bring a lot of societal benefits, particularly in public safety and public health. And of course, the COVID, you know, situation is showing how important those applications can be. But so while, yes, it's been very much leveraged, running the race to 5G, this is a global phenomenon. And adoption is already well ahead of earlier generations of technology, showing, you know, the importance countries ascribe to it in terms of its economic and societal benefits.
Larry Spiewak, you get the final word.
Well, thanks. And I echo both what both Trish and John have said, particularly in these difficult times. I mean, I think the amount of effort, whether you want to call it with the political motivating slogan or not, but the effort over the last couple of years that we have been dedicating to 5G and to our networks, we are bearing the fruits of that labor now. And I think, particularly in these difficult times, you know, kudos have to go to the U.S. broadband and wireless industry. And also kudos to the commission, which has been doing yeoman's work. I mean, every day you read stories about people sharing spectrum in places where they needed to add capacity. Chairman just today opened up on a temporary basis the 5.9, which is still an open proceeding, just to get Wi-Fi out to rural areas. This is a shining moment, and I think this industry is one of our finest hours, and I'm very, very proud to be part of that. It's just very nice to see that this community is coming together, this industry, to really help the nation in its very much time of need.
Thank you very much. So this is Dean again. Thanks to our guests, John Neuer, Larry Spiewak, Trish Paoletta. We certainly appreciate this. I think it's been a very interesting discussion. But until the next call, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.